It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Candy cigarettes. This is one of my favorite things as a kid. They tasted like sweet chalk, and we would suck on them imitating movie stars. I mean, there is nothing like a seven-year-old trying to look like Audrey Hepburn in Breakfast at Tiffany's. Well, apparently, those regional American candies are being wiped out by large companies. So here's my question. Where are the slow food and locavore gangs when we need them? I mean, we resuscitate local breweries, cheesemakers, and antique apples. Are we too elitist to support the local American candy maker? Think about it. We talk with you and a lot more this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. These days, we try to save a lot of local traditional foods, but you've got to wonder if some snobbery hasn't entered the picture. I mean, for instance, regional candy bars. They're a dying breed. And this is from the Wall Street Journal. The mom-and-pop businesses that have conjured regional candy bars since before Washington crossed the Delaware are being wiped out by big business. Now, they were the stuff of everyday American life. Goo Goo Clusters, Fat Emmas, Twin Bings, Dipsy Doodles, and Wacky Wafers. None of this is news to Steve Almond. He's a writer who's been in love with the American candy bar since childhood. Well, he did a book on these mom-and-pop outfits. It's called Candy Freak. Steve, welcome.
Thank you.
Steve, you know, this is what occurs to me. We have revived the local brewery. We have revived or encouraged artisanal local cheesemakers and bakeries. But we don't do anything for the candy makers.
Well, we don't do anything that is sort of in the same scale of economy as a brewery. In other words, you can get a local brewery that sells a beer that, you know, is maybe a little bit more expensive than a six-pack of Bud, but not that much more.
Right.
There are some amazing local chocolatiers, but what they're not able to do is make a piece that is affordable and can stand in the candy racks next to the big three, now big four, candy companies that can make candy bars for whatever it is, 69 cents.
I'm thinking about all the great candy bars you introduced us to when you were on the show a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
sure.
This has to be like you losing some of your best friends.
Well, I don't want to make it sound too dramatic, mostly because it will reflect poorly on me as a human being. Like, candy bars aren't as important to me as people. Actually, that's not true. They're not as important to me as my family, anyway. But, you know, the Twin Bing, the Vallow Milk, the Idaho Spud, the Goo Goo Cluster, you have to think of them as really the dinosaurs, essentially, of a certain kind. And this is how fast American capitalism has moved. And they're really vestiges of a time when, in fact, most of our foodstuffs were made locally or regionally. And every city that we went to had a great brewery and a good bakery and a confectioner or two or even 12 if you're in a city like Boston, like I live in, or in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very sad for me, but it's also something that's in effect in a broader way all across the culture. We're eating, you ever take a drive across country, we're eating the same stuff everywhere.
Yeah.
We're wearing the same clothing, and drinking the same soda pop. And there's something, it's not that that's a great tragedy. It just is part of the reason that people are hungering so much for a sense of identity, I think, because, you know, the late model capitalism has just leveled the playing field. We're buying the same stuff everywhere we go with the same plastic carts.
So what has been lost of late?
Well, the main thing that's happening now is that big companies, the way that they respond to the fact that people really do want variety, they want to try lots of different things, is that they introduce all these sequels. You know, the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup has about six or seven different variations that they introduce one a season, and then that disappears. They'll introduce a bar like the Kit Kat Dark or the Hershey's Cookies and Mint, for instance, and it's sort of like a tease, Lynn. They throw it out there for a season to get to get you to buy a few extra bars, and then suddenly it starts to disappear. It's like a little mini ice age all over again. But the broader thing that I would say is that we've lost our palate of what sort of candy can be and what flavors can be has really, really contracted. It used to be back in the 20s and 30s, the boom years of the candy industry, there were so many amazing flavors. There was pineapple. If you lived in an area where there was fig, there would be figs in your bar. There was a lot of coconut. There was a lot of different interesting fruit flavors. Those are completely gone now. You pretty much have about six different ingredients that make up almost every bar. And I don't know that, again, this isn't like a Shakespearean tragedy, but there's something about the way in which our taste buds sort of are wearing blinders now that to me is sort of sad.
So, Steve, have you got a couple of candidates for protection?
That's right, confectionery protection or
yes.
preservation.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I haven't quite booked my ticket to Washington to appear before the Senate subcommittee on confections. But I would say that there are a couple of companies that I think are just as wonderful. You know, the Vallow Milk, Cypher's Vallow Milk, was around big bar in the 20s, a very rich vanilla syrup with this delicate, delicious chocolate cup. It gets all over your chin when you eat it. It's a total mess.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah. Yeah, it's really great.
That's really what candy bars should do. I mean, they're really a delicious, regressive pleasure. They shouldn't be a neat experience. So I would love if they were, you know, somehow protected. And I would love it if the Twin Bing was as well, and also the Idaho Spud.
You sent me a Twin Bing. And
okay,
I loved the Twin Bing.
The Twin Bing is an extraordinarily strange candy bar. It is a cherry fondant, which is sort of like a cream, a little richer than a cream.
Right.
And it's covered with something called a chocolate hash, which is ground peanuts and this sort of chocolate compound. And then there's two of them, so they're sort of stuck to one another. It is not what I would call the most appetizing-looking bar, but it is it's an exquisite taste because it combines the sort of saltiness of the peanuts with this intense sweetness of this cherry fondant. And I love it. The first one I had, I was very like, this is too weird. This is, you know, my tongue can't quite deal with this. And then about a half an hour later, it was like, where's the next Twin Bing, pal? And I love all of these bars. I think they're so fantastic, and they're such a link to our past. You know, we vote with our mouths and we vote with our money. And the people who support these bars are slowly, you know, aging and then eventually dying out. And that's the reason that it's incredibly difficult for these bars to survive. And the only way to really reverse that is, you know, for people to, for you to take up the bandwagon, take up the cause of the Twin Bing and the Vallow Milk and, you know, hit the streets and start popping them in people's mouths.
Steve, thank you.
Absolutely.
Steve Ahman's latest book is Rock and Roll Will Save Your Life. Now, you know, I can't talk about all that candy without talking about what I think is the great classic, the marshmallow dipped in chocolate. Now, there's a recipe on the website. It's for Lynn's homemade marshmallows. You add the chocolate part. You can find it at splendidtable.org. You know how there are some people who do recipes you just like to read? Well, Melissa Clark is one of those people I enjoy. She does the column A Good Appetite in the New York Times. This woman has lusty tastes, which is why she joins us. Melissa, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So your latest lusty moment for me, you did the column, what was it, Saving Money and the Soup. And I'd love to hear your take on all of this.
Well, that was my recipe for shrimp bisque. And a lusty is the perfect description for this bisque because it was so full of pieces of shrimp. And I used fennel and I made a really quick shrimp stock. And, you know, something happens, I think, with the flavors of the shrimp and the fennel and a little bit of rice and then this homemade shrimp stock. It came together and it was so rich in the mouth, yet so light at the same time. It was one of those moments where, you know, sometimes when you're developing a recipe, you're coming up with something, it takes a few times before
right,
you get it.
Right,
this
yeah.
was, I just put everything together and it took on a life of its own. It just did its thing in the pot. And when you said lusty, I was making it with my husband in mind. He was in the back of my head. I wanted to make something really delicious for him.
Tell us about this process of how you use those shrimp shells.
So what I did was I wanted to make, I knew I wanted to make a, some sort of rich shrimp soup. And the shrimp I wanted were these Gulf shrimp from Mexico. And they were the most eco-friendly shrimp that I could buy, but they had the shells on. And I thought, oh, do I really want to deal with the shrimp shells? But I ordered them because I wanted the shrimp. And I have a funny history with shrimp shells because I grew up in a household where we used everything. My parents were, you know, nose-to-tail cooks. And so naturally, they wouldn't think of buying shrimp without the shells because for the same price, you get these shrimp shells. And my mother would turn them into this stocks and soups. She'd make pâtés out of the shrimp. And she'd always take the shells and simmer them down into a rich, like a rich shrimp stock or a shrimp glaze. And of course, the second I left home, I thought, okay, well, forget this. I'm never going to. You know, I was going to I was a rebelling college student, and I stopped buying the shrimp with the shells because there was my mother's voice in my head saying, if you have these shrimp shells, you can't throw them out. You can't let them go to waste. You have to make a shrimp glaze. And even though it was easy, it just seemed like I just didn't want to do it. I was just having my own my moment of rebellion. And then, of course, you know, decades later, here I am confronted with these shells. And I thought, you know, hey, Mom, I remember you. I remember this recipe because I had seen her do it so many times. So I took the shells. And it's really easy to shell a shrimp. If you've never done it, it takes about 3 seconds per shrimp. You just pull off the shell. I don't devein. Lynn, do you devein?
Between you and me, only when it's a huge shrimp and somebody's going to see a big black thing in it, because otherwise, yeah. No, I don't bother. That's
right.
Fiddly cooking.
It's fiddly cooking, and especially for, you know, normal extra large shrimp. And so I had my shells, and I just remembered what my mother had done. I sautéed them in butter. And the reason you sauté them in butter is because you want to bring out, you know, shrimp themselves, the meat of shrimp is very, very sweet. But right. The shells have a more briny, deep ocean flavor. And if you sauté them in butter, you'll also get a layer of sweetness on top of that. So that's a very important step. And then I added a little bit of wine and brandy because alcohol also helps extract the flavors from the shells. And you just let that simmer for a few minutes. I added a bay leaf. And I let it all, and more water, and I just let it simmer for about 20 minutes. And at the end of that, and it was so simple. It was, I didn't, you know, talk about non-fiddly. I just threw it all in the pan, sautéed for a minute, added these other ingredients. And then I had this rich, oceany, briny, very sweet, with a little bit of brandy, this wonderful stock. And that was the basis for the soup that we're talking about. And, you know, something else about shrimp, or any kind of seafood, if you're ever going to make a seafood bisque or a seafood soup, the reason that you want to use the shells and the reason this is so important is because you can't simmer the shrimp by themselves for very long because they're going to get overcooked. You know, if you cook shrimp for more than 5 minutes, it turns to rubber. You can't get the flavor.
Right.
But if you can, if you do it from the shells, if you use the shells, then you can get a rich, deep flavor from long simmering. And that was what was so great.
And the long is 20 minutes.
Long, exactly.
Right. So and it's free. Yeah. That's the other piece of this.
Yes.
You know, Melissa, I'm looking at your recipe, and bisques usually always have cream in them. You don't have any cream in this bisque.
I wanted a lighter flavor. And, you know, cream, when you add cream to something, you know it's going to taste delicious, but it really is its own flavor. And I think that as well as it works with shrimp, I wanted the flavor of the shrimp to shine. I wanted something more neutral that would act as a binder, but that wouldn't kind of take over the way a creamy soup kind of takes over your palate.
It coats it.
So I thought about adding rice instead, because what rice does is it binds the soup. And then when you puree it, you really don't even notice that it's there. You can kind of tell that it's thick on your tongue, but you can't tell it's rice. And rice and shrimp are such a great combination that it seemed like a natural.
That's brilliant. It also cuts back on the fat.
Yeah.
Really great idea. Hey, thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Melissa Clark is author of In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite. Now, you can find her recipe for shrimp bisque on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, gefilte fish and brisket in Mexico. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. I was recently surprised to stumble across a recipe for gefilte fish in the Veracruz style, as in gefilte fish from Mexico's Veracruz. Now, of course, there's Jewish Mexican food. It's just that it's something we don't think about as we're inundated with the tacos and the burritos in this country. Jews have a rich food heritage in Mexico, one that appears to blend almost seamlessly at times. Well, here to fill us in is chef and writer Patricia Hainich. Patty, it's good to have you with us.
Hi, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Patty, how did Jews first come to Mexico?
Well, you know, not many people are aware of this, but we can trace back the arrival of Jews to Mexico to the late 1490s, you know, the time of the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, when many of the Jewish people had either to convert by force or to convert in order to survive. And around the same time, Cristobal Colón set sails to look for, you know, new lands.
Right.
And many people don't know that quite a few of his companions were Jewish conversos who, you know, arrived in Mexico late 1490s.
Now, when you say converso, you mean someone who has converted to Christianity, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So they arrived, and did they form communities? Or
so they arrived in the beginning, you know, in the 1490s and early 1500s. There were very few, and they practiced in secrecy because of the establishment of the Catholic Church and the Inquisition. And to this day, Lynn, you can find people in the provinces who, you know, in their homes, they eat fish on the Shabbat on Friday and light candles, and they don't know where those roots came from. But, you know, for like 300 years, when Mexico was a colony of Spain, not that many Jews kept coming. But after Mexico became an independent country, then waves of Jewish immigrants started arriving, you know, with the pogroms and the dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire, and then, of course, the First World War and the Second World War.
So when they came, did they adopt the food of, you know, the local people? Because they wouldn't have any chance to do anything else, right?
Yeah, Lynn, you know, it's really interesting because the Jewish food has very defined guidelines, you know, partly because of the religious elements, you know, the kashrut rules, which mean you can't mix meat with milk or cheese, no seafood, no pig.
Right.
So they brought the Jewish foods with them, which kept their soul and their meaning, but became incredibly enriched with all these new ingredients and exotic elements. And so you have some dishes. I mean, you need to have an acquired taste to eat some of these dishes, like gefilte fish. You know, the traditional gefilte fish. I love it because I grew up eating it. But honestly, people that don't know it very well may not be that happy when they look at it. And in Mexico, in any household that makes gefilte fish on a Friday night, there is a Veracruz version, which is absolutely to die for, Lynn.
Mm. Now, if I have this right, Patty, two areas of Judaism, essentially. I realize there are many others, but two basic areas. The Ashkenazi, who came from Europe, especially Eastern and Northern Europe, and then the Sephardic, who were the peoples of the Mediterranean. Did I get that right?
Yes. And it's very different cuisines. And of course, you know, in each of those groups, you have variations. But the Eastern European and the Ashkenazi are more cold country foods that are typically boiled, have the potatoes, the onion, the carrots,
right.
They have pickled herring. And then you have the Sephardic, which is a much sunnier, much richer, more sophisticated tomatoes and dried fruits and nuts. And a funny thing, Lynn, is when I moved to Washington, D.C. here like a dozen years ago, I met this Israeli friend. And when I was explaining to her, you know, the differences in Jewish Mexican food, and I was telling her, yeah, you know, the Arab Jews. And she's like, the what? And I said, you know, yeah, because in Mexico, we call the Sephardic Jews, we call them Arabs. And it is an endearing term. It's just, you know, we say either Ashkenazi or Arab, but my Israeli friend was completely in shock by the distinction.
Well, what's the difference there? I mean, it sounds like the Sephardic food would transfer very easily into what we think of as Mexican cuisine, but perhaps the Ashkenazi doesn't?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as far as the Sephardic food, Lynn, it just went on a joyride with Mexican ingredients because the Sephardic food already had all these, you know, sour and sweet elements. It had the tamarind and it had the tomatoes and the dried fruits. And then add, say, chipotle peppers to that, add ancho chilies to that. Mm. And it goes very well with the Mexican food. You're right.
Are there Jewish communities still in Mexico? I mean, are there communities where people who have come from specific parts of Europe or the Mediterranean our all living together.
Thrived. I really think the history of Jewish people in Mexico has been a warm, cozy story. When you think about the two cultures, the Jewish culture and the Mexican culture, there are center elements that the two cultures share. There's focus on family. There's a focus on food. I like to say that there's this Woody Allen-esque, you know, sort of. And I live it every day, Lynn. When you mix a Jewish mother with a Mexican mother, we are obsessed with feeding our children. I will make my kids go run around the block so they can eat a little more.
Patty, thanks so much.
My pleasure to be here, Lynn. Thank you. Anytime.
Patty Heenich runs the culinary program at the Mexican Cultural Institute in Washington, D.C., and hosts Patty's Mexican Table on PBS. Her recipe for gefilte fish in Veracruz sauce is on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, when people hear what Jane and Michael Stern do for a living, you always hear that same line. It's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it. They track down the best in local eats, and they report their finds on their website, roadfood.com, and here. Hey, guys. Welcome. What's the latest?
Hi, Lynn. We have been in Seattle, Washington, and let me cut to the chase here. We're going to recommend a cupcake bakery. Now, already I can hear all the foodies out there going, oh, no, not another cupcake. Because, yes, cupcakes have maybe had more than their moment in the sun. However, a great cupcake really needs to be celebrated. And Michael and I went to a place called Cupcake Royale, which probably had the best cupcake I've ever eaten. It was a salty caramel topped cupcake.
Well, it was salty caramel on top, but like fudgy down below. So it was like that great combination of chocolate, caramel, and a little bit of salt.
Oh, that sounds good. That really.
Yeah, it was great. But if I had to make one complaint, the cupcakes often are way too fresh, meaning that the minute you pick one up, it kind of disintegrates because it is still so warm and it falls all over the table and you have to spend a lot of time picking up hunks of cupcake and, of course, drinking that wonderful Seattle coffee on the side. So
it's
that's
a great
my complaint.
Sacrifice, Michael.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah, life is tough. Lynn, a great cupcake was inspired by Elvis.
Ah, yes.
And it's a banana cupcake with a chocolate peanut butter frosting topped with a crisp dried banana chip.
Oh, this sounds great.
So beyond that, that's it. That's just, you know, the epiphany.
Now, there must be a ton of cupcake places in Seattle.
There are. Actually, there are, you know, throughout the Pacific Northwest, cupcakes are really popular. You know, cupcakes have had a renaissance in the last several years, but they are especially good in the Pacific Northwest. I'm not sure why. Maybe because it's such a coffee haven, and cupcakes go so well with coffee any time of day.
And I don't want to start a war here, and you know that I'm an Easterner, but I do have to say that the Pacific Northwest has it all over New York City with cupcakes. They are just beyond the beyond from Portland to Seattle.
I think on that note, we had better say goodbye. Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Michael.
Bye, Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest tome is 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you can find all their picks, past and present, on the website, splendidtable.org. It is time for us to talk We are opening the lines for you. You can get to us at 800-537-5252 or email splendidtable.org. Anything goes. Okay, let's see who is calling. We have got Angie calling from Greeley, Colorado. Angie, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about birthday dinner.
Whose birthday?
My boyfriend's.
Ah, so you're going to be doing the cooking?
I am.
And what are you thinking of doing?
Well, I found some phenomenal ribeye steaks at the store, so I picked them up
right.
And have been pondering what to do with them.
How thick are they?
They're about 1.5 to 2 inches thick.
Oh, that's great. They're cut the right. Yeah, this is what you want. You don't want these little thin steaks. First of all, if you want to make the best of the best, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do it on the grill.
Okay.
Work with wood charcoal, or if you have the kind of grill where you can actually have small hunks of wood, because you can buy small hunks of wood.
Mm-hmm.
Do it with a wood fire. It just maybe you're already working with wood charcoal, but it's such a clean tasting, delicious way to work. And if you can do it with something like fruit wood, something that has a little bit of flavor on its own, it just sort of ups the ante, okay?
Okay.
Now, the trick to a great steak is you should have the meat cold, because the idea is that the slower it cooks on the inside, the juicier and the more evenly cooked it's going to be and the tenderer it's going to be.
Interesting.
Yeah, and if you have it cold, that means you can char it. You know, really get it crusty and brown. You want a two-zone fire. One side of the grill is going to have maybe 4 or 5 layers of coals. And the other side of the grill is just going to have a layer of maybe, you know, two layers of coals.
Okay.
So what you're going to do is you're going to rub the steak with some olive oil, and you're going to sprinkle it with coarse salt and ground pepper. All right.
Okay.
It goes over the high heat side of the grill to get it brown on both sides, and then you move it over to the other side and you cook it really slowly, turning it. Because the food scientist Harold McGee came up with this. And one of the things he talked about, he said, you know, people talk about you're not supposed to handle a steak. You're only supposed to turn it once or twice.
Right.
He talks about how the moisture of the steak migrates away from the heat. So what you want to do is keep migrating that moisture back and forth.
Oh.
So flip the steak occasionally. And you'll know – and you're going to give it a 10-minute rest. That's the other important thing, because that's when everything relaxes. It finishes cooking and it all the juices collect. If you cut it right away, you lose everything.
Right.
So the idea is, if you want it, let's say, medium rare – how does your boyfriend like his steak?
About medium or medium rare.
Medium rare. Okay. Take it to about 130 on an instant reading thermometer at its center, or 135. And then you remove it to a plate.
Mm-hmm.
Keep it warm, but just let it sit for about 10 minutes. Now, what you've made ahead of time, is a gremolata sauce. Have you ever had it?
I've had it. I've never made it, though.
All right. It's grated lemon rind, minced garlic, lots of chopped parsley, salt, pepper, olive oil, and a little lemon juice.
Okay.
And I would mince it with a knife rather than doing it in a food processor. If you have access to any preserved lemon, you know, the lemon that's packed in salt and from Morocco, I would use part lemon rind and maybe 1/4 of a preserved lemon minced up. You'd rinse the lemon first, pat it dry, mince it up. But you do that to taste. But the idea is it's lemony, garlicky. It has some olive oil. It has some parsley. But now here's where the fun starts. The steak has rested. There's going to be some juices on the platter that you're going to serve it on, right? You pour a little olive oil onto the platter.
Okay.
And you lift the steak, get the olive oil into the steak. You put a little bit of the gremolata under the steaks.
Oh.
And then you put a little bit of the gremolata on top of the steak. And you serve it. And if he doesn't plots over that, he's not the man I think he is. Okay? And happy birthday to him, and happy cooking to you, ma'am.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Angie.
All right.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Let's see. Oh, we have got Anthony calling from Sacramento. Anthony, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about spices.
Oh, okay.
I love spices, and at my house, I have a whole cabinet full of them, and if I see a new one, I try it.
Right, right.
But when I'm cooking over at my sister's house, especially for my nephew, who's 11, their repertoire is a little bit more limited. Like garlic and seasoned salt is pretty much the basics.
Right, right.
So what I'm looking to do is try some new spices with my nephew to introduce him to the idea that spices doesn't mean hot. It means flavor.
Ah.
So I was kind of thinking along the lines of rather than introducing new foods along with the new spice.
Yeah, that may go too far. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe do something a little more bland like mashed potatoes or something along those lines.
What does he like to eat? You're right. I agree with you. I think this makes a lot of sense. Does he like mashed potatoes?
He likes mashed potatoes. Christmas time, we tried couscous, and surprisingly, he really liked that.
Oh, that opens up some really interesting possibilities, doesn't it?
Yeah, and he's very adventurous. He's much more adventurous than I was when I was 11. I was one of those that turned up my nose at stuff, but
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He's willing to try it and say, oh, I don't like that, or yes, I do like that.
Well, you know, does he like rice, by the way?
He does.
Because, see, all of these things are starches, but they're great carriers of
right,
flavor.
Right, that was what I was going for.
Yeah. Okay, with the couscous, one of the things you could do is toss it with melted butter. Now, but the first thing you're going to do, and by the way, this could apply to potatoes and it could apply to rice,
uh-huh.
is melt that butter and in that butter warm up some grated fresh ginger,
ooh.
Obviously salt and pepper and a little bit of garlic.
Uh-huh.
And then toss that with the warm couscous.
Okay.
And see how he responds to that. Now, you can bake cooked couscous and rice, all right, with cinnamon sticks and raisins and clove, you know, and a little bit of ground cumin as a balance. Very Moroccan, a little sweet paprika, not hot. Toss that together. Maybe you have some olive oil with that couscous just to moisten it very lightly. See how he responds to that. With his mashed potatoes, try chopping fresh dill and a little browned onion.
Dill and onion. Okay.
Yeah, dill and onion is a classic, and it could be utterly delicious. And maybe a little bit of lemon juice in that mixture.
Okay.
Another thing to think of is to do thyme, fresh thyme. With those potatoes or with rice.
Uh-huh.
And maybe do that with orange zest.
Oh, that would be good.
Wouldn't that be delicious?
That would be good whether he likes it or not.
Well, yeah, it would be delicious. But the idea is you might warm that in a little bit of olive oil. And you get that lovely combination. The thyme comes alive. The idea is when you cook those spices, just to warm them. And add them to the cooked potatoes or the cooked rice.
Kind of bloom them a little bit.
It blooms them a little bit.
Yeah.
And he can tell you, and you could do that with just a little bit of the rice or the potatoes and say, what do you think? Oh, you don't like that? Hey, well, I've got another idea. You know, you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Get him in on the act. Hey, Anthony, thank you. That was a great question. I think a lot of people are curious about how you start tasting things.
Thanks.
New things. You take care.
I will. You too.
Okay. Bye. 800-537-5252. Or go online, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. And the question is, why is lamb potentially more dangerous than a car? Well, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment. And we're going to be taking more of your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. Hi, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be back to your questions in a moment. You can find us on Facebook, get to us on Twitter, or cut to the chase and pick up the phone. Call us, 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, why is a lamb more potentially dangerous than a car? Well, it's because they belch. The Wall Street Journal reported that researchers now believe livestock industries could be producing more methane gas, now that's greenhouse gases, than cars do. Sheep belching is being researched in New Zealand. Now, this business of the burp is pretty challenging because grass eaters with multiple stomachs, that's sheep, cows, and goats, generate methane gas. You know, it's hard to believe that a pasture of fluffy white creatures could possibly be doing more harm than that brown cloud from downtown traffic. Okay, back to your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or send us an email,
SplendidTable.org. Okay, let's see who's up. We've got Josh on the line from Baltimore. Josh, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm calling because my crazy friend wants to do a pig roast at his bachelor party. This will be my first pig roast and his too. We have a fair bit of cooking expertise among the people who are going to be there, but not a single pig roast among us.
Yeah. Okay.
And I'm going to add a couple wrinkles. Not only are we pig roast naive, but we're starting in Baltimore and driving down to where we're spending the bachelor party weekend, which is in some cabins in West Virginia about 5 hours away.
So you're going to have to travel with your own pig for your pig roast and with your own equipment for your pig roast, right?
Well, the pig almost definitely and the equipment probably. So where I am so far is I know I got to find a clean pig, and I know that I have to come up with some sort of elaborate roasting contraption.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, the first thing that occurs to me is, have you guys considered finding somebody not terribly far from those cabins who does this?
Which, when you say does this, you mean
does the roast for you or can help you out? In so many words, they can be there with you. Yeah, you'd have to pay them. But the idea being is somebody who really knows what they're doing. Because with a pig roast, now I'm not saying it's impossible to do at all, but you have got to keep a low, low fire going for a very, very long time. I'm talking, you know, 7 hours, 8 hours.
Right.
And you know, that takes a certain amount of experience and a certain amount of skill. And having someone who is in the area, and, you know, West Virginia, there's a lot of great food there and there's a lot of people who know what they're doing. And having them bring in the equipment and then maybe you all working with that person.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
Yeah, because this is not something where, oh, gee, if it doesn't work, you know, so what? We'll order in pizza. You're talking about no, but it's true. I mean, you're talking about a really big investment. You're spending a lot for that pig. You're going to have to rent the equipment. And frankly, I would go with somebody who has a lot of experience. And I think that a good place to begin to find that person would
be question,
is to go online to sites like Chowhound, eGullet.
Okay.
You know, places where you've got a ton of people that know their area and you can just, you know, throw out, this is what I'm doing and I'm looking for somebody who's a pro at this, who has the equipment. And by the way, you might actually have a response from people who are right there online.
Nearby.
You know, and then you can sort out the ones you think you want to work with. But that would be my advice. I wouldn't, I really wouldn't, I mean, if you were doing this in your backyard, you know, and in the middle of a city or a place where you've got access to a lot of stuff, I'd say, oh, for goodness sakes, go for it. But you're talking about being in a remote situation where, you know, if you don't have everything you need, if something, you know, if something suddenly fails, you're gonna have a problem.
Understandable. One more quick question is, would you be at all hesitant, assuming I get the pig in Baltimore frozen, to transport it, you know, the five-hour drive and then start the roast the next morning?
I would consider that asking for a lot of hurt.
I thought maybe.
Yeah. I think what you want to do is keep the pig on ice. And this is all the more reason to have somebody local. Get that pig for you. No, you don't really want to do that. It's like defrosting something on your counter. It's
fair
exactly
enough.
The same idea. And it's yeah, no, don't do that.
Loud and clear, Lynn.
Right. I just want all you guys alive, well, happy, full of good pork, you know, probably some sort of beverage that might help it all go down and
have
a very relaxed time.
All right.
Hey, Josh, thank you for calling.
I appreciate your input. Thanks a lot.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or send an email, splendidtable.org. Well, we got an email from Charlene in Virginia, and she asked, what are the different kinds of rice and what dishes are they best suited for? Well, there are probably more rices than we can count in the world, Charlene. I mean, there's black rice and purple rice and red rice and short rice and long rice and, you know, jasmine and basmati.
every rice has a different quality and a different flavor. And I say whenever you find a rice you've never tried, try it. But almost all rices break down into three different categories, and these are the dead giveaways of how you might use them. There are long grain rices, okay, and you can tell because their grains are long and narrow, and these usually cook up to be really fluffy individual grains. So these are the rices you might use for pilaf, you might use for that bowl of rice that's going to accompany the stew or the dish. This is a rice, a lot of people use this rice for rice pudding, but you can use the rice for almost anything. But do know this is the rice that is going to be fluffy. This is the rice that you can toss very easily with vegetables in a wok and come up with a fabulous sauté for a quick supper. Now, the next kind of rice is a medium grain rice. It's shorter and it's stubbier. And the thing about this is, the difference between all three is that their starches are chemically different. So they cook differently and they have different textures. The shorter grain or medium grain rice, this makes a creamier rice. These are not going to be fluffy individual grains. Now, these are the rices that you want to use for things like risotto. These are the really great pudding rices, in my humble opinion. So that's where that rice sits in. And then there's the short grain rices. And their starches make them very sticky. And this is the Thai rice. If you've ever been to a Thai restaurant and you get this rice that almost comes in a ball and it sticks to each other, that's a short grain rice. And it's sometimes called sweet rice or sticky rice. And this is the rice that's often used in Asia for desserts, where it's cooked with coconut milk, and then things like pureed mango are blended in with it. And then you serve it in little balls or just little mounds, and it's really fabulous. So basically, it's long grain that's fluffy, medium grain that gets creamy, and short grain that gets really sticky. And that's the area that all the rices fall into. And thanks for a great question. 800-537-5252. Give us a call. We've got Ann calling from Memphis. Ann, what is on your mind, dear?
Hey, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call. I want to first thank you. You're so creative. I love your show and your wonderful guests and the great ideas you come up with.
Well, thank you.
And the last idea I took of yours, and this is what's on my mind,
yeah,
is your roasted pears. Oh, my goodness. They were just great. I own a restaurant in Memphis called Just for Lunch, and we made roasted pear tarts. We made roasted pear salad with mountain gorgonzola and toasted walnuts, and we just went crazy with your roasted pears. But I am looking for something, I hope you can help me,
yeah,
with a spring idea, something like Peter Rabbit salad for the spring, but with something
different,
some unique ingredient.
Okay. You know, one of the things, I always end up doing something like this at this time of year too, is taking a local fresh cheese. And by the way, if you don't have a local fresh cheese that makes sense financially,
Tennessee goat cheese.
You got it. You're there. Okay. You make little balls of it. Just use a melon baller, you know?
Yes.
Right? And then what you do is you toast up some whole almonds, all right? And you mix them with some chopped or snipped chives or scallion tops and a little bit of hot chili powder.
Yum.
And you roll those little balls in that. What? Do you have sugar snap peas yet?
Yes.
You do?
We
okay.
Did.
All right. This is super. This is just super. You're going to do sugar snap peas. You're going to do greens.
Yes.
Okay. The little balls. And then what you're going to do is you're going to roast chickpeas with red onion and and I'm just thinking one other thing that we need in that. Red onion and cherry tomatoes.
Okay.
So you got a lot of different stuff going on, but the thing that's carrying it all are these really tart, snappy greens.
Yum.
All right. So arrange those on a plate. You know, get the greens really looking perky.
Yes.
Have the roasted stuff just at room temperature.
Yes.
Sprinkle that over it. Then dot it with this sort of red and green with the nuts, little balls.
Yeah.
Right? And then the thing I would do is a dressing with that, which would be really nice, would be something like toast whole cumin seed. Okay, in a little, very light toast.
Yes.
Whole cumin seed and some fresh ground black pepper in your olive oil for salad, and a little orange zest in that. And then what you do is you blend into that vinegar and a little orange juice. And
what
you
kind
make
of vinegar?
I would use a cider vinegar.
Okay.
And it doesn't have to be wildly expensive. I would blend that together to make a toasted cumin orange dressing. And it's not sweet. It's that bitterness of the orange with a little orange juice in the vinegar. If you wanted garlic in there, you could have garlic. But that's your dressing. It's a vinaigrette, but it has that toasted cumin flavor that's going to set off all those other tastes.
Wow. Well, I can't thank you enough. I could never have thought of that one.
Well, it's a weird mixture, but I think it's the kind of thing that every forkful is going to taste different. And that's what I love in a main dish salad for me.
And you could add free-range grilled chicken or
absolutely
fish of some sort.
Absolutely, yeah, if you wanted to, if you wanted to. But your protein is coming from, you know, both the beans and then the cheese. And,
well,
and you know, it's but it's that basic idea.
Well, I can't thank you enough. I hope you'll come to Memphis. We have a lot of good food in Memphis, and we have a barbecue. And it's a lot of fun.
And it sounds very tempting. I have been in Memphis and eaten brilliantly, and I look forward to returning.
Okay, thank you.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. 800-537-5252. If you start thinking about what makes food taste the way it does, and then you begin to backtrack, for instance, you start with the cooking, then you go to the buying, then to the growing, well, eventually you come to the land and to the earth that it's grown in. Well, artist and agricultural activist Laura Parker takes this idea to its logical beginning. Laura holds her Taste of Place programs in her San Francisco studio. Laura, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So, Laura, what's this Taste of Place thing about?
Well, it's actually a process where people smell the soil and taste food that comes from that exact soil, where they can identify the concept that each has its individual taste, each place.
Right.
This is an art project, and so it's somewhat performance and installation. And so there's a very nice bar, and people come up, and they come to the bar just like they'd be ordering a glass of wine.
Right.
And I hand them a glass with 2 tablespoons of dirt and a little bit of water, and they swish it around, and then they smell it. And at this moment, I have a glass in front of me of this beautiful T&D Willy soil.
Can you explain what that means?
T&D Willy is a farm
right.
in Madera,
oh,
and their soil is a Visalia sandy loam. And so this soil, when you put a little bit of water in it, it coats the side of the glass like thick chocolate.
Hmm.
And when you smell it, you get the scent of the sand, and it's from the Central Valley, so there's a little bit of mica in there, and it's really rich because it was flooded for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so all of that organic matter has gone into the soils. And then what we're tasting is actually a Japanese turnip that was grown in exactly this soil. So it's a young little white turnip.
So are people actually tasting the dirt, or is it done through scent?
It's done through the other senses.
Right.
And that's the first thing everybody asks me is, do I really have to eat dirt?
Right.
You know, you really don't. And the first thing that I see happening when I get going is all of a sudden people are sticking their fingers in it, and they go, oh, can I really taste it? And of course you can if you like, but you don't have to. It's really based on the, you know, the physiology of taste, which means when you smell, the scent falls on the very back of your palate. And then when you taste that food, you know, it passes over your tongue. So the two experiences marry, and you can see if you can smell what you taste and taste what you smell, because they intermingle in your mouth.
How do people react to this?
Well, it's all over the map. Some people come up to the bar and they say, oh, this is a joke. You're kidding me. And 5 minutes later, they're standing there and they're going, oh, I get it now. you know, some people, many of us, haven't actually spent 5 minutes paying attention to the earth and nothing else.
Many of us never get that close to it.
That's true.
The thing. Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, I'm hooked. It sounds like a fascinating thing to do. Hey, Laura, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Lynn.
Laura Parker is an artist and agricultural activist who offers her Taste of Place programs in San Francisco. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can contact us anytime, connect on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or give a call, 800-537-5252. Have a great week, and let me leave you with this thought from Henry David Thoreau, who said, "Shall I not have intelligence with the earth? Am I not partly leaves and vegetable molds myself?" The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Now, while you're there, check out this month's book giveaway. You can win your very own copy of Gabrielle Hamilton's memoir, Blood, Bones, and Butter. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear and Steve Cornier. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. You have a great week, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.